Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Most gun-free zones in Wyoming are null and void after a law went into effect this month.
There are all kinds of what-ifs, from the what-if of a misfiring firearm because of negligent handling.
We check in with Wyoming's Superintendent of Public Instruction on the recent lawsuit pausing school vouchers from getting distributed.
It's really unfortunate. We have just under 4,000 families in the state that were counting on those dollars.
Some people in our region are waiting for the day they can hunt grizzly bears. Others are happy hunting with a camera.
I'd rather see them with my eyes through my camera.
Those stories and more. Stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Hello, Human Nature listeners. This is Megan Feary, the host of the show, here to tell you that a brand new season is coming your way May 21st. This season, you'll hear the story of a woman who overcame incredible hardships by turning to her constant companion, the river. Also, the story about how a random act of kindness saved an animal sanctuary in need. And Fitz Cahal, host of the Dirtbag Diaries podcast, joins me to discuss his new book. Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Wyomingites with concealed carry permits can now bring firearms in public spaces where it used to be banned. Think public schools and colleges, some parts of airports, and legislative committee meetings, to name just a few spaces. That's after a law repealing most gun-free zones went into effect on July 1st. States that went in a similar direction saw more gun-related injuries, according to a new data analysis. So I talked with state government reporter Chris Clements about its findings, its limitations, and how school districts are responding to the end of gun-free zones. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Of course, Camila.
All right. So what are the supporters of this law saying about why it was needed?
I asked Wheatland Representative Jeremy Haroldson that. He's a member of the Wyoming Freedom Caucus and a top Republican in the House. He basically said that more guns will make sensitive areas like K-12 schools safer from violence.
And I look forward to just seeing what that means for the safety of our students, the safety of our employees and workers in our government buildings.
We should mention that academic research shows more guns often lead to more crime, not less. And there was some pushback on the law when it was moving through the legislature, right?
Yeah, when it got to Governor Mark Gordon's desk for his signature, protesters held a die-in at the state capitol to try and convince him to veto it. One protester, a student at the University of Wyoming named Aiden McGuire, told me he lost his dad to gun violence.
Increasingly the norm in the United States and in Wyoming with this legislation is that everyone has some personal interaction with gun violence and knows that fear of that experience. And continuing to expand the places in which someone can have a gun isn't going to stop that.
But the governor ended up letting the bill become law without his signature, and it went into effect this month.
Okay, and we mentioned an analysis at the top, so could you tell us about that?
Totally. The analysis was written by the Gun Violence Data Hub, which is part of a nonpartisan newsroom called The Trace. They write about gun violence in the U.S. The Data Hub compiled a snapshot of gun-related incidents in Georgia, Omaha, Nebraska, and Ohio before and after their similar laws were passed.
So bottom line me here, Chris.
Well, using data from the Gun Violence Archive, or the GVA, the Data Hub found that gun-related injuries, deaths, and incidents in those three jurisdictions rose after their laws were passed. The GVA is a nonprofit that catalogs incidents of gun violence using police reports, social media posts, and news stories. It's important to note, though, that there's a chance the data used in the analysis is an undercount of how many gun-related incidents actually happened. That's because not everything gets reported to the police or has a news story written about it.
Okay, so the GVA collects public gun-related incidents all over the country. And are there any other limitations in the analysis?
I spoke with Kenneth Alexander Adams about that. He's a fellow at UW's Firearms Research Center, which is partially funded by the firearms industry and the State Department of Health. Before he came to the center, Adams was a consultant at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. He echoed a lot of the questions about the Data Hub's findings we've been hearing from our audience.
It's very possible that a lot of these changes could merely be explained by the fact that population in these jurisdictions that were studied went up over the course of the study period.
He also asked whether some of the incidents in the analysis were what he calls justifiable homicides.
Even if there were an increase in firearms incidents, it may merely be reflecting changes in defensive gun use, which does lead to a somewhat different conclusion as to the potential social benefits and costs of these laws.
So I asked George Levines, an editor at The Trace, to take another look at the numbers with those two points in mind, population changes and defensive gun use. Levines and another reporter who worked on the analysis found that for Ohio, the state population fluctuated by about 1% during the time period before and after their law passed, with no recorded incidents of defensive gun use. For Omaha, the city's population actually declined during the time period, with two cases of defensive gun use before more lax concealed carry policies and two after. For Georgia, its population went up by about 2.5%, with no incidents of defensive gun use before or after their law went into effect.
Interesting. Were there any other concerns?
Yeah. Adams said the analysis doesn't show these states' new laws caused the increase in gun-related injuries, and Levines agreed with that. It was just a comparison of incidents before and after these gun laws were passed. The analysis didn't set out to be a scientific study that uses control groups to figure out that question of cause. That was never on the table. Levines summed it up.
It's important in these situations to not let perfect be the enemy of good. It's a years-long project to come up with any definitive causal conclusions in these situations. That being said, a before and after snapshot is a useful tool.
So the goal of the analysis was not to establish a direct link between the laws and the increases, but to take a snapshot of other places that experienced similar laws. It's useful, Levine said, because it could be used for a more in-depth reporting investigation, or to form the basis of a study that does use statistical modeling to determine what might have caused the increases.
Okay, and what can Wyomingites take away from the story?
One thing to note is that the increase in the number of gun-related injuries occurred across all three states, and Levines told me that given how limited the data were in the analysis, it might not even be possible to use more rigorous modeling methods to get at causation.
You could even make the argument that it's a little journalistically and intellectually dishonest to ignore some facts when you have them, even if they're not like the most pristine and clean facts available. The truth is often a very muddy business, even though we'd like it to be black and white.
Why is the data so limited?
So for years, gun rights activists have lobbied state governments and the feds to keep gun records from being digitized and therefore readily available to the public. That includes records at the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which is the only federal agency that monitors firearms in the U.S. The Trace's Gun Violence Data Hub exists to try and fix that. The Data Hub gets funding from the Candida Fund, which lists gun violence prevention as one of its objectives, and the MacArthur Foundation, which funds research into gun violence.
Good to know. So let's turn to something more tangible. How are these previously gun-free zones like public school districts, universities, and colleges implementing this law? I understand that there's some leeway that these facilities have to figure out how they want to enforce it, right?
So they don't have to provide any extra guidelines or requirements for staff and faculty who want to concealed carry guns on campus or at school board meetings, but they can if they want. They can set specific training requirements for those carrying guns in schools. Plus, they get to choose whether or not they require guns to be put in lock boxes or biometric boxes during meetings.
And I know you spoke with Brian Farmer of the Wyoming School Boards Association about how the law is affecting schools. What did you learn from him?
A lot, Camila. One highlight is that some school districts' property and casualty insurance rates have gone up now that the repeal on gun-free zones is in effect. That happened to Teton County School District Number 1 and Laramie County School District Number 1, according to Farmer.
There are some commercial insurers in the state who have taken the position that the authorized carry of firearms introduces new risk, and that new risk merits an increase in the premium because the insurer is uncertain of what liability might look like for them.
Beyond that, Farmer told me that lawyers for school districts are having trouble interpreting such a far-reaching law.
Legal counsel who have tried to guide districts on this have struggled because of sometimes the vagueness of the law or lack of clarity within the law.
For example, can school district officials ask for proof of people's concealed carry permits? Is it a bad idea for them to have metal detectors now, given guns will set them off? Then there's concerns about safety. What happens if an angry parent brings a concealed weapon to a parent-teacher conference and the situation escalates?
There are all kinds of what-ifs, from the what-if of a misfiring firearm because of negligent handling. What if a person intent on doing harm poses as if they have a permit?
And for the record, Farmers Association, the WSBA, has a stance on this subject. They think the issue of gun-free zones should be a locally determined decision.
That's right.
Well, you'll be continuing to report on this law's impacts. Thanks for being here with me today, Chris.
Thanks, Camila.
School's out for the summer, but administrations, staff, and lawmakers are still focused on Wyoming education. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor spoke with the Superintendent of Public Instruction, Megan Degenfelder, to talk through some of the issues, starting with recalibration. That's when, by law, the state is required to look at the education funding model every 5 years. This is one of those years.
As our superintendent, our chief of schools, what is your role in that process?
Well, we help to facilitate the recalibration process in partnership with the legislature. They, of course, hire a third party that provides that process, but really making sure that we can be a resource to them, provide the necessary data. That's really the most important role for the Wyoming Department of Education.
The consultants and lawmakers who are crafting that plan do have some new direction from a very high-profile recent lawsuit. The court in that case directed the legislature to invest more in teacher salaries, mental health resources, but lawmakers also still have a lot of other decisions to make. With all of that in mind, what are you hoping to see from recalibration?
Well, you're right. We find ourselves in a very interesting times with the appeal still ongoing in that litigation, but also having recalibration take place at the same time. And that's because our state constitution requires that we have an adequate and equitable education. I'm hoping that we can really take a look at, in the future, how we analyze the actual basket of goods that we are costing out. What changes could be made there if we want changes, in fact, to our education funding. I think that in this recalibration process, it will be good for the committee to look at things like mental health, to look at things like nutrition. And I've always, as someone that came from the private sector, I've always thought, can we make Wyoming the state that pays our teachers the greatest salary in the country, but we also have the highest expectations in the country? So how do we look at things like incentive pay that other states have grappled with? What does continuing contract look like? Because when I talk to our outstanding teachers across the state, they don't shy away from things like incentive pay, from doing away with continuing contract, if they know that compensation is going to be appropriate for the work that they're putting in.
Let's talk about the families who opt out of public education. And let's start with the educational savings accounts, better known to most people as school vouchers. These are part of a new program that provides public money for families to use on private school tuition or charter or homeschooling costs. The first payments, up to $7,000 per child, were supposed to go out earlier this month, but the Wyoming Education Association is challenging the program with another lawsuit. They claim the $50 million backing that program would be better spent on public education. What do you think of that argument?
So I think it's really unfortunate. My job, I view, is to provide great education options for every single child in Wyoming, because the key to a robust state and a robust nation is education. We knew that there was a strong likelihood that this would be challenged in court. But what's the most unfortunate is the suit was filed less than 2 weeks before our first payment, with the ask for the judge to make a decision just 2 days, 2 business days before our first payment. And so, it's really unfortunate. We have over or just under 4,000 families in the state that were counting on those dollars, and providers all across the state that made hiring decisions, planning decisions for the upcoming school year based on that.
Do you know how many of those 4,000 families were already in private school or homeschooling or out of public education? Because I think those families are maybe in different boats at this moment.
I've heard from families in both situations. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but there have been both. And then another piece of this, of course, is the pre-K program. So pre-K was included in the bill for low-income families. And one example that's really heartbreaking is a mother who took a job with the assurance that she would be able to receive this voucher to send her child to pre-K. And she finds herself asking us at the State Department whether or not she should now quit her job.
I want to ask you about the flip side to all of this. The Education Association, with its lawsuit, is pushing back on what they see as the negative consequences of this program. For one, they argue that you, as the superintendent, won't be able to have the same kind of oversight that you have with the public school system, because even though these schools are getting public money, the state can't tell them what to teach or what not to teach. One example raised in the lawsuit is that a religious school could be teaching creationism instead of evolution. Should public dollars be supporting that?
Well, I think an important distinction is with a fraction of accountability is also a fraction of dollars. So getting $7,000 a year is less than half of what a student would otherwise receive to be in public education. And so that often gets left out of the conversation, that there's minimal dollars and thus minimal accountability. I also like to remind folks that this isn't just $7,000 that comes to a family in the mail. There is a marketplace in which we have approved providers that are vetted through our professionals at the State Department for their appropriateness. And so there is some level of accountability. Students also have to take a national norm assessment as well as part of the bill.
The lawsuit also raises concerns about discrimination. The same religious school could also deny admission to transgender kids, for example. We're concerned about families being able to have school choice, but what would you say to the parents of a trans child who don't want their tax money winding up at a school that would deny that child?
I did see that that's part of the lawsuit, but what I don't see is that there's any particular example where that has occurred. And so I think in all of this, where I'm struggling to understand where an injunction is appropriate is the harm. There's been no harm that has been shown.
The lawsuit itself suggests there are maybe schools in Wyoming that would do this, deny transgender kids, but I'm not able to verify that claim. But let's restate the question. Should a private school receiving public money through this program be able to turn away a transgender child because of their identity?
Again, I've seen no example of this occurring at all. And so until I see harm, I think that this just is creating, unfortunately, a political spin on this and trying to take down the program based on events that have not occurred.
The lawsuit argues many of the same points about children with disabilities. Private schools don't have to accommodate children with disabilities in the same way that public schools do. Should public money go to schools like that?
Once again, these claims, I have not seen any instance of that. Again, this is the parent's choice whether or not to take their child to use funds towards these particular providers. The program is about making sure that every single child in the state of Wyoming receives a robust education that best fits their needs.
We might get a ruling from the court this month. What do you hope to see?
So I certainly hope that an injunction is not granted. Again, I have failed to see where harm exists for students in the public system. I hope that we can begin disbursement of monies to those families that are counting on it for this upcoming school year. I think that the most important thing is that we have kids being educated come fall of 2025.
Superintendent Degenfelder, thank you for chatting with me today.
Thank you.
The Game and Fish Department has been busy. We check in with the director on some recent updates. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Media is providing Wyoming and Western wildfire updates on air and now online. Go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Wyoming Wildfire Info. You'll find links to the latest updates on fires around the region, along with information on current air quality conditions, fire restrictions, information on protecting your property, and more. Find it all in one place at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Camila Kadelska. There are a lot of changes in the pipeline for hunting and fishing rules. Several proposed changes are out for public comment, from who qualifies for landowner hunting licenses to setting up a commercial fishing guide system to otters. With the Game and Fish Commission set to meet next week, I asked the Game and Fish's director, Angie Bruce, to talk us through what's been proposed. We started with landowner licenses, which are special hunting licenses made available to certain landowners. That's to give them a jump on the general public who win licenses through a lottery. Many non-landowners see these licenses as a big advantage to landowners.
They've been working on this issue since 2023. They've talked about it at 7 commission meetings, which are public, and just haven't got much of a response. And they really wanted to hear from landowners. And they decided that if they put out some proposed changes, then they will get feedback. And they were right. We got so much feedback. Currently, to give you perspective, landowners get just under 4,000 landowner licenses a year. It's about 3% of the total available. So not many in the big scheme of things, but yet a lot of landowners may be affected by any proposed changes. So the commission will visit the subject July 15th. At the Casper Commission meeting, which is public. In fact, they've actually dedicated the entire day to the discussion, which rarely happens. So they are really serious about allowing time to have a good conversation with the public if these changes should go forward or not.
And what are those proposed changes?
Currently, if you have 160 acres of continuous acres in the state, you qualify for a landowner license. The proposal they put out there is to change that to 640 acres. And if you have ranch land, if you had cultivated crop, such as row crop, irrigated fields, it would still remain at 160. The second change that they have proposed is you must have at least 20% ownership in the property
to be qualified for the landowner license.
Absolutely.
Got it.
And then currently, there is a wildlife component to qualifying. We talk about it as 2,000 animal use days. It's a formula we look at to see how many big game species or turkey are using the area over the year and come up with a use day estimate. Part of the proposed change is to take 2,000 and go to 3,000.
You said we got a good amount of comments from the public. What's been kind of the wide range? Is it positive? Is it negative? And if you can summarize that.
There's been an overwhelming amount of landowners expressing their opposition to the proposed changes. Those landowners over the years have highly valued getting those tags. And so this would take, with these recommendations, about a third of those landowners or more, it's hard to predict, would no longer qualify for getting the landowner tags. Therefore, they would have to apply like the general sports person in the raffle and put their chances out there to get the tags.
In response to these public comments, the Game and Fish Department axed the proposals Bruce just mentioned. It still includes expanding the definition of immediate family to step family members, and the commission will still spend July 15th considering what to do with landowner licenses. So moving on, in addition, there's a couple of new laws that the department has to implement. Let's start with the Game and Fish regulating commercially guided fishing boats for the first time. Where are we in that process?
Wyoming does not have a registration or regulation process for fishing outfitters and guides. A lot of our neighboring states do. And legislators, as well as the general public, decided it was time for us to get ahead of this before it becomes even more of a problem in the state.
And how is it a problem now?
You know, we all have our favorite fishing spots out there, but what people have seen over the years is some stretches of river and some water bodies getting more and more occupied with boaters. It doesn't affect our fisheries, but what it does affect and what we're hearing from the public is about their quality of experience. There is an assumption that a lot of these are outfitters or guides. This first step in the process will help us gauge how much of a problem it is. So we have put out for comment some regulations that would be a requirement for them to register. They would pay a fee, they'd put in their information needed, and then they would be provided a sticker for their boats so that we could also manage this in the field. But what this will do after a year or two, it will allow us to say, oh, there's maybe 20 outfitters and guides on one day using this area. And it'll help gauge the fact that do we need to go to the next step, which would be regulating them. And you know, when it comes to regulation, that means limitations is really what we're getting to. They will have a lot of this summarized and ready to go this fall. But anticipating more work will be needed after we get this first round of information back.
And then another new law that got a lot of attention this year is about otters. So they're no longer considered wildlife.
So a lot of folks thought, oh, this was going to allow hunting. No, no. A lot of more steps would have to happen. And the population would have to be at a level that it was recovered in order to do that. The otter has been slow to recover in the state, more slow than most states across the nation, primarily because we have not moved the otter around. We had a native population, so we've let those native populations expand and come back. This will not really change much at all, except for what we can do to manage nuisance otters. As a population grows, they love to take over areas such as, you know, individual small farm ponds and affect the fisheries populations and other things. And we are limited by anything we can do. So this will give us a tool by moving them into non-game to be able to trap them and translocate them across the state to deal with those problems.
And lastly, I just want to touch upon the Wyoming State Wildlife Action Plan, also known as SWAP. So the state is starting a revision. It's required every 10 years. Let's just start off with, what is this?
Yeah, so the State Wildlife Action Plan was a requirement that the Fish and Wildlife Service put into place in order to receive some additional funding from the federal government for species that are beyond game species. That funding every year is just under $900,000. And it's extremely important because that is a key funding source for us to manage species that aren't hunted in the state. How we are set up in Game and Fish in Wyoming is 100% of our funds come from hunters and anglers. And so the hunters of the state are paying for wildlife management. And this gives us this extra source to focus on species with the goal of, we call it species of concern or species of greatest conservation need. And the idea is to keep them off the endangered species list. We went through a public survey to ask folks about changes that they would like to see in the state plan. We're currently drafting that plan and plan to have it out for public comment in the spring.
Speaking of wildlife, Yellowstone National Park is in the midst of a record-breaking summer for tourism, and many of those visitors are on the hunt for grizzly bears. As Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach reports, the hunters are armed with cameras.
It's 7:13 in the morning, and I'm driving through fog so dense I can barely see the cars in front of me. There are bison in the meadows, but I don't stop. I'm meeting up with some bear spotters in the park. As the skies start to clear, I park at a fishing bridge.
There's a grizzly out here that's going to walk across this marsh probably momentarily.
Tanner Haver, a bright-eyed filmmaker, says fellow bear watchers texted him that the bear is roaming nearby with an elk calf carcass.
Big bear with a scar across its nose.
That's Haver's grandpa, Rick Lee Browning, a school bus driver from the Denver area with piercing blue eyes and a flannel shirt.
I've been bringing Tanner up here for 20 years.
And I actually saw my first bear at 5, and since then it was like all over.
About 4 million people come to Yellowstone each year. Every summer, this duo stays in Cook City, Montana. It makes the over an hour drive here almost every morning, so Haver can film the bears.
There's no place like Yellowstone. You know, you have this spectacular stuff happening right off of the highway.
Haver is wearing skinny jeans and Crocs. Since we aren't doing much hiking today, I'm just waiting for the bear to come to us.
All right, I'm giving up on him.
Giving up?
Yeah, let's go find something better.
We hop back in the car, and after a couple more stops, we end up a few miles up the windy road, where dozens of drivers are parked haphazardly, staring at something across the ridgeline.
So you're up there?
Oh, yeah!
Finally, way in the distance, we see a 5-year-old grizz traversing the hillside. Though Haver already has a lot of shots of her, since unlike the scar-faced male, she likes to hang out near the highway.
Have you been watching her for this whole 5 years?
Yep, every year.
He won't whip out his 40-pound camera setup this time. Still, he says seeing bears like this never gets old. It runs in his blood. His family has been around them for decades in one way or another.
My uncle ran an outfitters up here. I'd come up and play dude boy for the summer. I've been on 3 grizzly bear hunts.
Leaning against the tailgate of his truck, swiping through old digitized slides, Browning says this was right before grizzlies were listed on the endangered species list in 1975, when hunting was still allowed.
And my uncle leased ground from Yellowstone, and they took the rogue bears that had given them trouble the whole year long in the park and dropped them off on the property. And that's the bears that you took the hunters up to hunt.
Now, when bears have conflicts with people, they're relocated or euthanized.
Yeah, it was a whole different time back then.
For years, debate has raged over whether or not grizzlies have recovered enough to be taken off the endangered species list, which would mean states could start hunting seasons. Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana have argued that grizzlies have rebounded, with 1,000 of them in this area. But in the last days of the Biden administration, it announced it would keep the bears on the list, so no hunting.
I'm not against bear hunts in this ecosystem if it's done properly and if the management practices aren't completely out of line with science.
I agree, but I don't want to see it. I'd rather see them with my eyes through my camera.
On this now blue sky day, we drive back to the fishing bridge on our hunt for that scar-faced bear.
So I take it he just boogied across this?
A handful of photographers gather. They tell us we just missed the bear. It had walked under the bridge.
No!
Owie!
Should have waited. That one hurts me.
But about a week later, Haver happened to come upon that same scar-faced grizzly and finally got his shot. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Yellowstone National Park.
This story is part of a series following people who get up close to grizzly bears as the debate rages on about whether they should remain protected by the Endangered Species Act. Wildfires are starting to spark around the state. Up next on Open Spaces, we check in on how a neighboring state is preparing.
This time on the Modern West, we trek out into the National Elk Refuge and hear all about the debate over whether to wean elk off winter feeding before a chronic wasting disease strikes.
You know, it's like an alcoholic. Oh, I won't drink as much and I'll be okay. Yeah, it doesn't really work like that.
Wasting Away, it's part 6 of The Gray in Between. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska. Each year, hundreds of wildfires strike in western states. In Idaho, the Nez Perce tribe is preparing for the season. They're facing challenges. It's getting harder to bring in new firefighters, even though wildland crews got a long-awaited raise. From our partner station, Northwest Public Broadcasting, Lauren Patterson reports.
It's mid-morning and the beaming sun is hanging over Lapway, Idaho. At the fire station, it's casting shadows into the bays where three firefighters are checking over equipment on their fire truck.
We have a daily checklist every day we go through. And
that's Riston Bullock, who's getting ready for his 13th season on the crew. Jalisco Miles is to his right with the checklist. He's in his third year. And Pharrell Hayes, a rookie, looks on. Bullock starts pulling on a pump to clear out the water.
We check our pumps and stuff like that. And if we have any hose hanging on here, we'll take it off, replace it with new hose. We got all of our tires are good to go.
Miles starts marking off the list with a pen.
After last year, we had a really big fire, and it changed my perspective a lot on it.
He says it made him realize how important the job is when lives are on the line. The experience focused him.
Getting there, making sure everything's okay, and getting to the call and keeping them small.
Hayes wanted to fight fire last summer, but he wasn't old enough.
Now it's my first year, so I'm excited for all that.
He's joined a crew of 8 firefighters who will spend the next 5 months on the front lines of local fire response. They've been getting around 2 calls a week, sometimes 3. Bullock says he does this job because he's dedicated to protecting the land and his community.
Now that I've been in fire for so long, it's kind of more being the first one to respond, put the fires out.
A big challenge here in Idaho and across the nation is that there aren't enough people to help.
We're losing firefighters. The numbers are going down.
People can still volunteer, but
we need people at the shop ready to go when those fires start.
Across from the shop in the air-conditioned office, Jeff Handel, the fire management officer, is on the phone trying to schedule repairs for fire trucks.
Okay, what I need is I've got a couple rigs that need radios put in
them. He's also worried the younger generation doesn't seem too interested in firefighting.
It's pretty tough in today's world when you can get a job and work from home and do okay financially. Why would you want to go out and do the firefighting thing, which is very hard work?
After pushing for years, federal wildland firefighters got a permanent pay increase through a spending package passed by Congress in March.
Now, the minimum is 15 across the board, and in most places, it's more like $17 or $18 an hour.
Back at the shop, firefighters are organizing equipment like ropes and hatchets. There could be changes coming to how the Nez Perce Tribal Fire Crew works with other agencies in the region. The Trump administration is trying to merge all federal firefighting into a single agency. That could mean shifting thousands of jobs around just as fire season is ramping up. Bullock says he's not sure how that would work.
I see it kind of being crazy because there's already one. It's called the Interagency Dispatch Office.
That office is based in northern Idaho. And Bullock says agencies like the Idaho Department of Lands and the U.S. Forest Service already work together and with the tribe.
I feel like it'll just kind of be a new name, but I still feel like we'll still have our shops and everything here. We'll be mixed out through each other, and it'll be, I don't know, it might be complicated.
For now, Bullock and the rest of the crew aren't giving it too much thought. They're busy getting ready for the next call. Reporting in Lapway, Idaho, I'm Lauren Patterson.
We just heard the Trump administration plans to merge all federal firefighters into a new standalone agency. Currently, each unit of federal public land manages fires within its own boundaries, with a lot of coordination and resource sharing with states and nearby local fire departments. To better understand the domino effects of this change, Wyoming Public Radio's Nikki Woulette spoke with Steve Markison. He led firefighting and fire mitigation on the Bridger-Teton National Forest and now runs a private consulting business for homeowners and neighborhoods to figure out how to lessen their fire risk. Woulette started out asking him what he thinks of the proposal.
So I don't think it's a bad idea. I just think it needs to be well thought out. It needs to be planned well. And it's not something we can just say, hey, we're going to do it like right now in the middle of fire season, which I'm a little concerned about because that seems to be the push.
Can you lay out what you see as the pros and the cons of making a change like this? Let's start with the pros.
Yeah, the pros. Well, it professionalizes the fire service. So that's a good thing. With that kind of support for pay and retention, it might help keep folks from, you know, leaving for other higher paying jobs with state agencies or other organizations. And I think there is that consolidation could create a synergy that would help as far as response and bulk up some of the resources together and a more coordinated response. But boy, I have to backtrack and say, you know, the interagency incident management teams and interagency programs and how we all approach fire, we're all doing it the same way. It's standardized across the board between the BLM, the Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Forest Service. So I don't really see any hiccups there as far as how they're currently working together. But I think the argument is, yeah, if it's consolidated into a professional wildland fire service, then it would get even more efficient and less bureaucratic. And I think there's a case for that in the long run. But on the flip side, some of the challenges, I mean, obviously there's logistical challenges. How are you going to take all the USDA Forest Service people who have offices and vehicles and computers and put them in with, you know, the Park Service? Where is everyone going to work out of? And how are those logistics going to be met so that they are more efficient, so that the organization is structured in a way that's less bureaucratic? And those really need to be ironed out before we even punch the button and say we need to do this.
Has that been part of what's been communicated in Trump's executive order or Secretary Burgum's talks about what they're envisioning?
I just haven't heard a lot of details about that. But in talking with my counterparts at the federal agencies, I don't think they've heard a lot of details either. And then the other biggest challenge to me is if we combine and we organize for kind of fire response in that way, is it going to be full suppression oriented, or is it going to be fire management the way it is right now? You know, right now, fire management programs are comprised of fire operations and suppression resources and fire line leadership, and they're coupled with the fuels programs that plan large landscape level fuel treatments on our public lands, either prescribed burning or mechanical treatments or thinning. They work with all the Forest Service and, say, the Park Service ologists, all the specialists, the wildlife biologists and the archaeologists and the recreation folks who, you know, collaborate with those fuels and fire specialists to implement projects like prescribed burning. And so where I haven't seen anything in any of the executive order literature, like how are those people going to fit in, and how do we collaborate with these specialists to implement projects on the pace and scale that we need to really, you know, lower risk? How's that going to happen with this consolidation?
Sure. You mentioned that this isn't like a brand new idea. This was being considered back in 2008. And at that time, the Congressional Research Service released a report about a proposal that would bring the Forest Service and the BLM into a single agency. And they found then that a wildfire agency would likely focus on fire control because acres burned are the most readily measurable performance standard. And anything seeking to reduce damages, like you're saying, protecting individual structures or just reducing fuels on the landscape to prevent future enormous burns, those are less likely to be emphasized.
Yeah. You know, I teach community wildfire mitigation practices all over the country with coalitions and collaboratives. And one of our premises is that we're not going to one more engine, one more helicopter, one more air tanker out of this problem. The amount of fuels on the landscape, the amount of fire suppression for the last 70 to 100 years, you know, we have conditions on the landscape and there's conditions with climate that we're just seeing fires that are outstripping our capacities. I'm not saying that control is not important. It absolutely is for protecting those values at risk. But that needs to be coupled with very strategic landscape level treatments, but also homeowner responsibility to harden their homes, to build defensible space, to swap out their roofs, to make sure their 0 to 5 foot zones from their house are clear of flammables and the things that will start homes on fire. So if we create a fire service that's just only control centric, I don't think we're gonna solve the conundrum we're in with large fires and huge impacts to communities.
If/when this change goes through, how do you see it kind of playing out in Wyoming, where so much of the land is managed by feds?
The way I see it, if I was still sitting in there as a fire management officer, there's a lot of logistics to work out as far as reclassifying people into their new positions, working under a new agency, transferring all your health, retirement benefits, and coverage into the new agency. That's not a big deal because, I mean, people go back and forth from different agencies. And then, like I said at the beginning, you know, organizing the resources, the engines, the actual trucks, the actual equipment, where you're going to store everything, who's going to work where. There's not enough space in Teton County for all agencies to work under one roof. There's a lot being done, but everyone's working either under DOI or USDA facilities, and the facilities and the vehicle part needs to be planned out strategically.
You know, the Trump administration is saying we need to avoid catastrophic flames like what happened in LA. We need to have faster response times. How do we do that?
We push for wildland urban interface building codes in every community, which isn't going to be very favorable. We have one in Teton County, and we're building fire resilient homes with Class A roofing and the right vent screening and the right landscaping. But, you know, that's not really palatable to the public to take on more regulation, and especially when you're building a home. But these are investments as homeowners and communities we need to make to be fire adapted. So that's really what's necessary. We need to work from the house out.
That was Steve Markison, founder of Teton Wildfire Mitigation Team, LLC, speaking about Trump's proposal for a single wildfire agency. The clock is ticking for negotiations about how to share water from the Colorado River. So what happens if the states that use it can't agree before next year's deadline? We'll learn more next on Open Spaces.
It can be hard to keep track of the news, but Wyoming Public Radio just made it a little easier. Now you can follow us on Apple News to get the latest stories from Wyoming right in the palm of your hand. Plus, you can get an audio roundup of daily local news in under 10 minutes with our new podcast. Check out Wyoming Debrief, a morning habit that pairs perfectly with your cup of coffee.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The clock is ticking for a new deal to manage the Colorado River. The current rules for sharing the river's water expire in 2026. There are rumblings of progress towards a new deal, but there's a long way to go before the seven states that use the Colorado River have a real agreement. So what happens if that deadline arrives and the states haven't inked a new plan? For the Mountain West News Bureau, Alex Hager has more.
There are a lot of words that come to mind when you try to answer that question. Unprecedented, messy, troubling, because even the most qualified people in the room don't know exactly what would come next. Brenda Berman is the former commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation, the federal agency that works on the Colorado River.
I think people are looking for a concise answer here, but there isn't a concise answer.
Berman says there isn't an exact roadmap for what might happen next, but she and others can give us some clues. So let's say it hits October 1st, 2026. The rules for sharing water written in the past couple decades are out the window. So we fall back to the rules that were in place before them, rules from the 1970s.
That's a nightmare scenario. And I don't think that the states or the federal government would allow that to happen.
That's Ann Castle, who used to work for the feds on water policy. Those rules, she says, were designed for a river with much more water in it. They would quickly drain our biggest reservoirs.
They're really woefully insufficient to operate the system in the hydrological environment we're in today. So Interior has to do something.
If the states are stuck, the Secretary of the Interior, currently Doug Burgum, steps into the role of water master. That gives him some power to make big decisions about who gets how much. Scott Cameron, currently the top federal Colorado River policymaker, says his boss is not afraid to use it.
Secretary Burgum is prepared to exercise his responsibility as water master. He's not looking forward to that, but in the absence of a seven-state agreement, he will do it.
So then it would come down to how the federal government wields that power. Option one, Burgum takes the path of least resistance and sticks with those rules from the 1970s. They would send a lot of water from the top half of the river to the bottom. So those upstream states, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico, they'd probably take him to court. Again, Ann Castle.
No one could possibly come up with a set of rules that pleases everyone. And they'll do what they think they have the authority to do, but we all know that lawyers may disagree.
Then how about option two? Well, there's a catch when it comes to Interior's legal power. Almost all of it is in those downstream states. So if the feds really wanted to do something bold and cut back on water use, that plan would disproportionately hit Arizona, California, and Nevada. And you guessed it, those states would probably sue. Mike Connor is another former federal water official.
In either situation, somebody's going to object and say, you're not acting consistent with the law. And sue the secretary to say you made a bad decision.
One other option, Interior could ask for an extension. It would take an act of Congress, but could give the states an extra year or two to find consensus about who will use less water. But the experts are all on the same page. The best option is for the states to agree now. To do that, they'll have to make uncomfortable compromises. Former Reclamation Commissioner Brenda Berman has these words of advice for those negotiators.
It's our job to live up to this legacy. It's our job to make sure that we are setting the path for the next 20 or 30 years of stability. And if we fail in that job, shame on us.
Climate change is shrinking the Colorado River, and cutbacks on demand are unavoidable, now and into the future. I'm Alex Hager.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced by KUNC and supported by the Walton Family Foundation. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also find that anywhere you get your podcast, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Melody Edwards, this episode's audio producer, Cody Hume, our digital producer and social media manager for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.